Second Judge Brian, the Honorable Kevin G. Ross presiding.
Good morning, please be seated. Good morning and welcome back to this October 13th session of the Court of Appeals. Thank you for allowing us that little bit of a break. Our next case on for oral argument this morning is International Fluid Power versus Hoth Gunther, doing business as Sea Legs. Counsel, each of you will have 15 minutes to present your argument with an additional 5 minutes to appellant's counsel for rebuttal if you'd like to use that time. As I've mentioned to the previous advocates, you'll see three different podiums and microphones in front of you. We're not expecting three of you to be there at once. You can simply choose, based upon your level of comfort and safety, whether to use the microphone at the center or whether you'd like to use the microphone at the podium closest to your table. Please be mindful of the timing restrictions. They're indicated in the lighting system in the middle podium. But again, you don't have to use that particular podium. State your name as you commence each leg of your argument. And with that, counsel for appellant, whenever you're ready to proceed, you have the floor.
Thank you, Your Honors. Counsel, may it please the court, my name is Ryan Dreyer, and I'm here representing Holb Gunther, LLC, doing business as Sea Legs. We're asking that the court reverse the district court's summary judgment decision for at least three reasons. First reason is because there was a fact dispute about what the terms of this contract were. The second reason is because even if this court were to affirm on what the terms of the contract were and whether there was a breach, there's a fact dispute about whether or not International Fluid Power mitigated its damages. And the third reason that we are asking this court to reverse the district court's judgment is because Sea Legs had a jury trial right on the attorney fee provision in this contract. So to hit the first issue, this is a contract case. UCC applies to this case. It's for the sale of goods. And one of the first questions the court has to do is figure out, well, what are the terms of this agreement? The key term that we're talking about here and appealing about is whether or not these contracts between the parties had a confidentiality term in them. And the evidence of this confidentiality term for Sea Legs was introduced through the declaration of John Holb, and it consisted of about three different things. First, it was a 2004 agreement, written agreement between the parties that specifically identified that the design of this power unit system, this hydraulic system, was proprietary to Sea Legs. The second piece of evidence in Mr. Holb's affidavit is invoices from 2008, 2009, and 2010 referring to the ownership of this design to Sea Legs. And probably the most important piece of this evidence in Mr. Holb's affidavit is his statement that, quote, this is on page 13 of his declaration, or paragraph 13 of his declaration, page 4, prior to 2016, IFP had honored our agreement that the design and products developed for Sea Legs were confidential and would not be sold to competitors pursuant to IFP's June 2004 proposal. So those three pieces of evidence show that one of the terms of the contract between these parties was that the design of this system was confidential. It's undisputed that that term, if it existed, was violated by International Fluid Power. They started selling our design and selling our secret information to our competitor, Northern Wholesale Equipment, and once Sea Legs learned about that, they stopped purchasing the product from International Fluid Power. So those are the terms that are in dispute. Now, what the district court did here is the district court weighed the evidence against Sea Legs. And we know that the district court weighed the evidence because of the language that she used in her decision. Page 12 of her decision, when the district court is analyzing this issue and trying to figure out, well, what are the terms of this contract and is confidentiality one of them, the court says, quote, more importantly, Sea Legs attempted to negotiate a non-compete after the purchase orders were submitted and it had learned about Northern's Ultralegs. The key phrase there is more importantly. The judge is quantifying the evidence of this confidentiality and this non-compete term. She's quantifying it from the party's affidavits. And the only reason you quantify evidence is if you're going to weigh that evidence. And that's what the district court judge did here. She weighed the evidence at summary judgment, and that is a misapplication of Minnesota law. As we all know, it's black letter law. The court can't weigh the evidence at summary judgment. The court went on then to award a breach of contract judgment to International Fluid Power. And the important part of this is that if this confidentiality term is part of the contract, then International Fluid Power breached the contract first, and they're the first breaching party. It releases CLEGS from further performance of the contract, and that's the nub of the issue in this case. So for those reasons, we asked, you know, we're asking that this court reverse the district court's decision on summary judgment and send that issue to the jury. When disputed facts are presented to the court has no option but to allow that issue to go to the fact finder and have the fact finder determine what the terms of the contract are. The second issue and the second reason that we ask that this court reverse the district court's summary judgment decision is even if it were to find that a confidentiality term was not part of the party's contract and move on to the analysis about whether or not International Fluid Power mitigated its damages, there too is a fact issue on that issue. The evidence here is in the declarations of both parties, same declaration of John Holb and the declaration of Al Sachek. And it's as the moving party and as the non-breaching or alleged non-breaching party, International Fluid Power had the burden to prove their case and prove that they had reasonably mitigated their damages. And what they did is they submitted the declaration of Mr. Sachek that said, hey, these parts that I sell to CLEGS and that I sell to Northern Wholesale, they're different. These are specially manufactured parts. I can only sell them to CLEGS. Well, that fact is in dispute because Mr. Holb in his declaration said, hey, I bought one of Ultraleg's systems, I took it apart, and I compared it to my system, and I looked at the different parts, and the parts are the same. There's one difference we admit is different, and it's this manifold piece that goes on top of at least the CLEGS unit. And if you're curious of what that is, there's a picture of it in Exhibit E to Mr. Holb's declaration.
Mr. Dreyer, I'm curious when you refer to the Holb declaration, what we can do in terms of relying on that if it was excluded.
Well, this court has to look at the district court's decision to exclude that evidence under an abuse of discretion analysis, correct? And it's a little unclear from the district court's decision about why she excluded the evidence, some of the evidence, from Mr. Holb's declaration. At one point, the district court judge says that, well, it's his opinion that's in this declaration, and I'm not going to consider it. But that's not exactly true. If you look at the assertions in Mr. Holb's declaration, they're the factual assertions. He is saying, I bought the Northern Wholesale system. I took it apart. I looked at these parts. And that part is the same as that part. That's a fact assertion. That's not an opinion. So the district court didn't get that issue correctly. It was not an opinion of Mr. Holb. It was a factual assertion. And at summary judgment, the district court has to accept those factual assertions in the affidavits as true. That's the standard. It's a black letter law in Minnesota. The court can't get into weighing the evidence, can't get into credibility determinations on these factual assertions.
It is proper if the district court were to conclude that there's no reasonable juror that could believe a statement.
That's true, and that's part of the summary judgment standard, but the district court judge didn't rule that there's no reasonable jury that could conclude that Mr. Holb's statement is true. Didn't get to that.
Could you direct me again in the brief that you submitted to this court the argument regarding abuse of discretion on this evidentiary issue?
Well, actually, I don't think we have that in our brief, and that was pointed out in International Fluid Power's brief. But, you know, I think that's the correct standard of review on that issue, and the district court did abuse its discretion because in parts of its decision, it found that Mr. Holb didn't have personal knowledge of the information in his declaration. But that is a credibility determination on paragraph one of his declaration, which says, I'm the chief operating officer of this company. I'm the president of this company. I've owned this company since 2003, and I make the assertions in this declaration from my personal knowledge. She has to accept that as true at the summary judgment stage, and he is saying that I make these statements from my personal knowledge. And again, they're not opinion statements. They're not hearsay statements in his declaration. They're factual assertions, and they're based on his personal knowledge.
If we disagree with that characterization, or put it differently, if we conclude that there was no abuse of discretion in excluding the Holb declaration, does that necessarily dispose of the second argument on failure to mitigate?
Yes, it does, because the...
What implications would it have for the first argument?
Well, the district court judge did not exclude the entire declaration. She just looked at the phraseology about the difference in the parts or the likeness of the parts between the two systems and said, I'm not going to consider that. She didn't throw the whole declaration out. So if you threw the whole declaration out, then there's really no evidence that would support Selig's position in this case, and it would be, you know, judgment.
No implication is to issue one because of the way the district court, the portions that some were excluded and some were not, but it would, if we were to disagree with you on the abuse of discretion, that would dispose of the mitigation because there wouldn't be any evidence to show they're identical products.
That's correct.
Okay. Thank you.
But that in and of itself would be an error because International Fluid Power, to support its motion for summary judgment, had to demonstrate that it had taken reasonable steps to mitigate its damages, and it did that through the declaration of Al Sawchuk. And Mr. Sawchuk's declaration relies on the same type of evidence that Mr. Holmes does. His statements that these parts are different and pictures allegedly showing that these parts are different. That's the exact same type of information that's in Mr. Holmes' declaration. Mr. Holmes' declaration is not relied on and is not considered by the court, but the district court relied wholly on Mr. Sawchuk's declaration with the same type of information in it, and no explanation is given by the district court why one of these declarations is valid and the other is not. It's the same type of information. If you throw it all out because it's allegedly opinion testimony from Mr. Holb, you have to do the same thing for Mr. Sawchuk, and in that case, they can't demonstrate the necessary elements of their cause of action for breach of contract, and they're not entitled to summary judgment. But the reality is, these are not opinion statements. They're factual assertions in both of these gentlemen's declarations, and that creates a fact dispute. That's why the district court erred in granting summary judgment on the mitigation of damage issue, and that issue should have been sent to the jury. Now, the third issue, and the third reason that we're asking that this court reverse the district court's decision, is because Selig's was entitled to a jury trial. So even if we lose on what the terms of the contract are, whether there's a breach, and whether the reasonable steps to mitigate the damages happened, we're still entitled to a jury trial on the attorney fee issue. I think everybody agrees that Minnesota's Constitution, Article 1, Section 4, requires jury trials or gives the right to a jury trial on contract-type cases. United Prairie Bank case has been cited numerous times. Everybody agrees on those authorities. And I find it moving here that International Fluid Power agrees on it too. In their memorandum of law in support of their summary judgment motion, they quoted that and said, Selig's gets a jury trial on the attorney's fees if we win this. During oral argument, Ms. Bushnell repeated that and said, based on the United Prairie Bank case, Selig's gets a jury trial if we prevail on the breach of contract case. The district court, in its summary judgment opinion, said Selig's gets a jury trial on the attorney fee issue in this case, unless one of two things happens. One, Selig's stipulates, or the parties stipulate to the amount of attorney's fees, or two, the parties agree that this issue can be submitted to the court under the court's jurisdiction with a motion. Neither of those two things happened. There's no evidence in the record to show that either of those two things happened. For that reason, it was an error for the district court to award attorney's fees to International Fluid Power. Now, this court has recently addressed this issue. I think it's called the Merchant and Gould case and I think it was decided in January of 2022, and the facts of that case are strikingly similar to the facts of this case. In both cases, there was a summary judgment decision on a contract. After the decision was made on the contract, the winning party, the prevailing party, applied for attorney's fees to the court. In both cases, the application for attorney's fees was granted, and the court issued an order for judgment on the attorney's fees. In both cases, a hearing took place after that where the attorney's fees was challenged. And in the Merchant Gould case, they appealed after that, and this court reversed, and it said they are entitled to a jury trial on the attorney fee issue because it arises from a contract. Our case is even stronger than the Merchant and Gould case because here we have the district court acknowledging that that's the law in Minnesota in the summary judgment order itself.
So just to be clear, there are multiple orders, and there are two different Rule 6002 motions and orders ensuing. You're appealing in this argument that you're making is really challenging the summary judgment decision more than it is the analysis under the finding factors.
Definitely not. Yeah, we're not really looking at the finding factors on this one at all because we're challenging the district court's original decision. It wasn't part of her summary judgment decision. It was later on. It was actually on August 20th, 2018 that she issued the decision awarding attorney's fees. That's the decision we're challenging. And we brought a Rule 60 motion in the district court to try to give the court a chance to correct its error. It didn't take that chance. But we didn't have to bring the Rule 60 motion to preserve our right to appeal and to preserve our right to challenge the judge's...
Same answer on issue four? Or are we looking at a review of the district court's application of, you said Findon, I say Findon, I don't know which it is,
sure.
Whichever.
Yeah.
Are we reviewing that, or are we looking at the...
On issue four, it is the Findon or the Findon factors on that one because, you know, that's where the analysis happened. And the issue on that one's pretty simple. I mean, Minnesota law is clear. You can't sue for the purchase price of goods unless you're going to deliver the goods. And what happens in this case if International Fluid Power is able to get these 1,221 cylinders or the purchase price for those cylinders and not have to deliver the cylinders to us is that they get a windfall. They don't do anything to these cylinders. They just buy them from Best Metals. They get shipped to International Fluid Power, and they turn around and ship them to Sea Legs. And they're asking for the entire purchase price for those cylinders, and they don't have to pay for them. And that is a windfall that's against the way the UCC works. I see my time has expired. And
yes, it is. But you will have 5 minutes of rebuttal.
Thank you.
Counsel for respondent.
May it please the court and counsel. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Sarah Bushnell, and I represent plaintiff, respondent, International Fluid Power. It's a pleasure to be with you again here in person. The case before you has occupied our courts for more than 5 years now. The district court did not err in granting summary judgment, and it did not abuse its discretion in denying the relief that Sea Legs sought under Rule 60 on either of the Rule 60 motions. In part, finality has been defied in these cases to date because Sea Legs made a series of litigation choices that it subsequently regretted. And that resulted in the two Rule 60 motions, which in my experience at least is extraordinary.
Can we start with the second, where we left off?
Sure.
The second Rule 60 motion. And I'm doing my best to interpret kind of how that was motion was presented and what the district court did. How do you characterize? Was it just a denial of the Rule 60 motion, but then under some separate authority, an adjustment or a clarification? Or do you think that that was a partial grant under Rule 60?
No, Your Honor. I think, and we didn't bring this out very, very clearly in our brief, but what actually happened was that before Sea Legs had even brought its motion, International Fluid Power had offered to give to Sea Legs all of the product that it had in its possession and control upon payment of the judgment. You can find that at Index 83. That's my declaration, Exhibit 5, and page 11, where I made that offer. The declaration was submitted to the district court on that second Rule 60 motion. And then the judge confirmed that agreement at the hearing, pages 26 and 27 of the February 2019 transcript. So said, you know, Ms. Bushnell, if Sea Legs pays the judgment, will you deliver the product that you have in your control? And then the remaining relief that Sea Legs was seeking under Rule 60 in that motion, as I understand the judge's order, the judge said Sea Legs has not raised any viable Rule 60 relief that it can show because it didn't look for this issue, it didn't discover this issue, it could have done that with due diligence. And it didn't do that, and it's too late to do it now, and I respectfully submit that was not an abuse of discretion. So that would...
You're saying that the authority under which the district court clarified, to use the district court's word, right, was the agreement of the parties? It wasn't some other authority?
Right. I think it was just done by stipulation.
Does that stipulation have anything to relate to the portion that is now disputed that wasn't, I'll again, adopt your framework, the products that were not in control or were not in your inventory at the time, did the stipulation relate to those at all? Because that's what's being disputed now.
Yeah, so it did not. We specifically excluded those, and you'll see that if you take a look at the offer that was made, and that I think that's clear in the transcript as well. The 821 cylinders to which the district court denied relief on that second Rule 60 motion, it denied the relief, again, because Rule 60 had not been satisfied, and we had not agreed to that because they weren't in our control. And we really didn't have an avenue to get those cylinders manufactured at that point without incurring additional expense, which would not put the non-breaching party, International Fluid Power, into the position it would have been in if Sealegs had not breached. We were either going to have to pay more for labor expense in the manufacture because so much time had gone by, or we'd have to pursue some kind of action against our supplier. We didn't have the cylinders. They hadn't been manufactured. You can see in our respondent's addendum that Mr. Holb from Sealegs had some interaction back and forth directly with the international fluid supplier who manufactures the cylinders and was given a choice. We'll manufacture these cylinders for you now if you want them. And John Holb basically had said, we don't want to do business with you anymore, and anticipatorily breach that contract. So the district court, again, did not abuse its discretion by concluding that those cylinders were not, that International Fluid Power did not have to deliver those cylinders upon payment of a judgment because, number one, Sealegs didn't meet the Rule 60 criteria, and number two, under the statute, International Fluid Power didn't have the control of those in order to deliver them. To address the jury trial issue, I'll take that one second. That was the first Rule 60 motion, and I respectfully disagree with my friend Mr. Dreyer when he says that Sealegs does not have to go through Rule 60 to appeal that decision. That is the only avenue open to Sealegs because Sealegs did not previously elect a jury trial at any time before it made that Rule 60 motion and before the order for entry of final judgment had been made. And Sealegs preserved no issue and no argument that would lead to a jury trial prior to that. It had never raised any fact issue, and I think that's a really important piece of that argument. The district court did not abuse its discretion on finding factor one when it concluded that Sealegs had not identified any evidence that would raise a fact question for a jury to decide. The issue about whether it's entitled to a jury trial is how the issue is going to be decided. But no party, regardless of whether entitled to a jury trial, just think about a usual contract dispute, if there's no genuine issue of material fact for the jury to decide, the party doesn't have a right to jury trial. Sealegs insisted on its Rule 60 motion that it had a right to a jury trial, which it would have done if it had properly elected a jury and had raised an issue for a jury to decide. But it didn't do either of those things. I will raise one issue that I think you'll hear about on rebuttal, and that is that when Sealegs made its Rule 60 motion, as I just said, it didn't identify anything for a jury to decide. We raised that in our opposition, and on reply, Sealegs said, well, International Fluid Power didn't agree in pre-suit settlement negotiations to a term that Sealegs had proposed about consumption of product within 18 months. And Sealegs says, well, ultimately, the district court did not rule in International Fluid Power's favor at summary judgment on the 18-month consumption term. And so if International Fluid Power just agreed to that term in our pre-suit settlement negotiations, then it wouldn't have sued and we wouldn't have had all these fees, and that raises a fact issue. And I just want to point out to you the district court's response to that, which I think was not an abuse of discretion and should be affirmed, and that is that was one piece of a pre-suit settlement negotiation that involved a lot of terms. CLEGS didn't present all those terms to the district court or the history of negotiation. And ultimately, the district court found that that 18-month consumption term wasn't really material to the dispute. CLEGS had anticipatorily breached the party's contract. At that point, International Fluid Power had the right to sue and was entitled by contract to its reasonable attorney's fees. No issue has ever been raised about the rate or the amount of time or any of the other things that a jury would need to decide about those fees, and CLEGS has not appealed the district court's determination that the contract does provide International Fluid Power a right to attorney's fees in these circumstances. On issue number two, we'll just continue moving in reverse order. Regarding mitigation of damages, there was no genuine issue of material fact that was raised about International Fluid Power's mitigation of damages. CLEGS, I think CLEGS' essential argument on this is that Northern Wholesale Supply ought to have been willing to accept products that it hadn't ordered, it didn't ordinarily buy, that didn't work naturally with its product, but that could be adapted to work with its product. And I'll tell you what I mean and where you can find that in the record. If you look at Mr. Holb's April 16 declaration, you will see that he identifies a number of component parts of the hydraulics that he thought were identical. The only one of those for which International Fluid Power sought damages was the pressure switch. The other products that he, components that he identifies as identical were products that we could resell, we did resell, we told the district court that we were reselling, and so we weren't seeking damages from CLEGS. The pressure switch, you can see for yourself, is not identical. That's Mr. Holb's April 23, 2018 declaration, and I believe it's Exhibit 10. This is a picture of the two pressure switches, one sold to CLEGS, one sold to Northern Wholesale, side by side. Clear fact testimony, and you can see it for yourself, right? I'm not a hydraulics person. My client takes me through Hydraulics 101 so I can understand this case. But you can see that one of those looks like you plug it into a wall, and the other one you couldn't possibly. And one is a Deutsch connector, one is a Spade connector. And so I think CLEG's argument here is that Northern Wholesale ought to have been willing to purchase the pressure switch that didn't naturally connect with its product and to buy an adapter or something like that. That's not the UCC standard because the circumstances reasonably indicate the parts are not identical. And so such effort to sell to Northern Wholesale a product that was customized for CLEGS would be unavailing. Same argument CLEGS makes with respect to the trial testimony. If you're inclined to accept trial testimony that was not before the district court, CLEGS says, well, Mr. Sawchuk said that Northern Wholesale Supply asked for some kind of an adapter or converter that could be used to put a Northern Wholesale pump, the pump that International Fluid Power sold to Northern Wholesale, together with a CLEGS lift system in the event that a CLEGS customer had a failure and wanted Northern Wholesale Supply to take over and fix that. But I think CLEGS' argument is then Northern Wholesale Supply should have been willing to take pumps generally for its products that didn't naturally go with it, that Mr. Gargiero testified before the district court at summary judgment that they had made improvements over CLEG's product, and so again, should take different products. That's not the mitigation standard. There was no evidence in the record that Northern Wholesale would do that. There was a great deal of evidence in the record that it wouldn't do that and couldn't reasonably be expected to do that. And finally, on issue one, the question of whether there was a confidentiality provision in this contract. The district court correctly determined there was no genuine issue of material fact on that question. There was no evidence of any understanding by International Fluid Power that there was any confidentiality requirement on its business relationship with Sea Legs. It's undisputed that the written agreements before the district court about the products that were at issue on summary judgment, there was no written agreement of confidentiality with respect to those. Sea Legs talks about the 2004 prototype agreement. That, if please look at that, it was very specific to that prototype, and there's no evidence, no suggestion even, that that product was ever sold or disclosed to anybody else. That was ancient history. Mr. Holb's only statement to International Fluid Power about confidentiality, according to his declaration, paragraph 13, was made in September of 2016 after all of the purchase orders at issue in this case had already been delivered and made. When Sea Legs raised the question of confidentiality, IFP said in writing that it never had and never would agree to terms of that kind. And as to course of dealing, please note that Mr. Holb explains why International Fluid Power had never sold to a competitor of Sea Legs previously in their relationship. Paragraph 4 of his declaration, he explains to you that aspects of the Sea Legs product were governed by a patent. That patent then expired. And in 2016, according to paragraph 10, he found that he had a competitor. Thank you.
Thank you. Councilor Appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
If you could begin where Ms. Bushnell left off with the exchange, the communication about the never had, never will agree to the confidentiality provision.
Sure, absolutely. So, you know, that's a disputed fact because John Holb's testimony is that we had an agreement on confidentiality. He didn't identify all the times throughout the 12-year relationship when they talked about confidentiality. But his declaration is that we had an agreement on confidentiality.
Right, but then the follow-up that yep. Ms. Bushnell didn't get to talk about, which was the Holb response, then let's go forward as we have in the past.
Yes.
Why doesn't that resolve the question to make this an undisputed fact?
If you read that whole email, what he's talking about is the non-competition agreement, and specifically the non-competition clause. And this is after Sea Legs had put together a thorough terms and conditions sheet and tried to reduce the party's oral agreement on confidentiality to a written agreement. This is after find out about Northern Wholesale. Sea Legs is trying to figure out what...
To the past...
Yes.
...seems to indicate a lack of an agreement in the past. It wouldn't make sense if there was an agreement in the past and he said, let's continue to do as we've done in the past.
Well... Again, he's referring to the non-competition part, not the confidentiality part. And there's a big distinction there, and that's the context of that email. Is talking about...
Is there any agreement at that time regarding non-competition that they, you know, reduced to writing?
Well, I think that there was, and it is part of the 2004 original purchase.
I'm talking about the attempt, as you're saying,
yes.
in 2016 to reduce... Now you're making a distinction between confidentiality and exclusivity,
yes.
but they're both being discussed.
Yes.
There's an attempt to reduce both into writing.
Yeah. And I think Mr. Holb's declaration or Mr. Holb's email...
My question was there a reduction to write or in writing? Did they reduce into writing this non-compete in 2016?
Not in 2016.
Okay. So I guess then I'm looking at back to that email where he says there's no agreement... And you're saying that only refers to confidentiality or non-compete, but it wouldn't make sense then because he's saying there was no agreement as to both. Then let's proceed as we have done in the past.
Well, another way to interpret that statement from Mr. Holb is to say let's just act as we have in the past, which is without a written agreement on these terms, right? And that's what Mr. Holbe was attempting to do with those written terms and conditions, is blow the oral agreements on what the terms of this contract were down into a writing so that all the parties could, you know, see exactly what the terms and conditions of their agreement were. They hadn't had that in the past. Admittedly, it's a better practice to do it. And that's what Mr. Holbe was attempting to do with that terms and condition, and I think that's the right way to interpret his email. Regardless, these are heavily disputed factual issues that the court should not have been deciding at summary judgment.
Is there any implication of the finding from the jury on the special verdict form that the misappropriation of trade secrets, that those weren't secret, they're generally known? Is there any implication of that finding as to confidentiality?
Well, not at the summary judgment stage, right, because the trial hadn't happened and this evidence hadn't been pushed out. So I would say no, there's no legal consequence for the jury's finding on that. But the jury was really being asked different questions. They're being asked in the context of a trade secret claim, you know, is this generally known in the public, and then which part? And there's multiple parts of this system that were tried to the jury. And so that's the question they're asking, is within the confines.
Any parts of the system that the jury found to be secret?
Were there any parts? I think the jury's first finding was that it is, get the phraseology wrong here, but I think they did find that it is, there is a proprietary design there. I might have the phrase wrong, but then the second part was, did C-Legs take reasonable steps to maintain its confidentiality? The jury found no. Of course, we disagree with that, and we think the evidence shows otherwise. But, you know, to the first question, is there something that's protectable there? Yes, there is, but C-Legs didn't take the appropriate steps to maintain the confidentiality of that, according to the jury. So, you know, a couple points I wanted to follow up on. You know, regarding that fourth issue about the 821 cylinders that were being asked to pay the full purchase price for, you know, the statement was IFP offered to turn over all products in its possession and control. Well, it didn't. These 821 cylinders, although Best Metals hasn't produced them yet, they're under contract with International Fluid Power to produce those. That contract is controlled.
Maybe you could take a minute to respond to the characterization that there was a stipulation and that it was under the district court's authority to clarify a previous judgment based on stipulation of the parties, and that's what was going on at the second Rule 60.02?
I disagree with that. I think the district court was asked to look at the summary judgment order, and we have a different judge that came in here. It was Judge Wall, who had replaced Judge Brazel, and there was obvious ambiguities in the district court, or the original summary judgment order. Judge Wall was asked to clarify that. He did that. He did grant part of this Rule 60.02 motion that we brought. He clarified it, and he said that Section 336.2-709 does apply to the judgment, and they have to turn over goods.
You're characterizing that as a partial grant of Rule 60,
yes.
Even though the judge also said there's not a basis for Rule 60 here.
Correct, and that's why we think the judge was wrong in his denial of part of our Rule 60.02 motion. That's one of the reasons we think he's wrong. I see my time is up.
Thank you, Mr. Dreyer and Ms. Bushnell. This is it's refreshing to get very thorough and in particularized, detailed briefing, and this case is no exception. Thank you for your work on the case, for your briefing, and for your oral argument today. The matter is submitted. We'll issue our opinion within the statutory period.